into myself again. But it's the only way you're ever gonna learn. You look back and it's all in the past. I'm dwelling on the thoughts I cannot say to you. If I don't say the words, then maybe it's not true.
Good evening. Welcome along to something which has been long overdue on this channel. In lockdown, I didn't just set this channel up to do football, but I also set it up to do a few things on true crime. Originally, this channel was a true crime channel. And during lockdown, along with Neil Jackson, I did a documentary series on here, a podcast series called My Time with the Crayers, which essentially... was going to take you on the journey that I went on as a young lad at school, and basically writing to the Cray Twins, corresponding with them, and then eventually visiting them. Now, in the last episode, which was probably about 18 months ago, we talked about Reggie Cray and my visits to Reggie in prison. So apologies to anyone who's tuned in for Football Crack. We did it earlier on, 2:45, the Ross Gregory Show. Tonight, I am going to take you on a little journey and through a few stories about this man, Ronnie Cray. Big thanks to Mickey Nesbitt and Wayne Lear. Britain's Gangland on Facebook put this together a while back. Just a selection of photos of what Ronnie looked like when he was in, not prison, but Broadmoor Hospital. I'm just giving you a little insight in case you don't know who the Cray Twins are. They are probably Britain's most notorious gangsters. Jailed for life with a recommendation of 30 years in 1969 after being arrested in 68 for the murders of Jack Lahat McVitie and George Cornell. And Ronnie Cray couldn't hack it in prison and was transferred to Broadmoor's Hospital for the Criminally Insane, which is where my story begins. And the photograph at the very end on the right hand side, the big photograph, which says 1994, even his wife says he looks quite mad. That's pretty much how I remember Ron. My visits started in 1990, and it was all through visiting Reggie Cray. So if you want to find out about the visit to Reg Cray, you'll have to watch episode 3, which should be linked in the video at the end of this at the end of this discussion. My mum at the time was a nurse, and she warned me what the atmosphere would be like in Broadmoor. She said to me that having gone to prison and having gone to Gartree prison and visited Reg, that I would be going into something completely different going into Broadmoor. It was a hospital. So there would be wards, and, you know, the difference, only difference from a normal hospital would be the fact that there would be bars on the windows. You would have to go through security. There would be bars. But the way my mum described it to us was exactly how it was. Pastel colors, she said. There would be like yellow and blue and calming colors for those people who were patients, not inmates. She was right about the security. It wasn't as probably strict as it is now, but it was still strict. First of all, I had to be passed by Ron's doctor, who wrote to me. Said that Ron had indicated that he would like to add me to his phone list, and also indicated that he would like to add me to his visiting list. I then had to send in proof of identification. I had to explain, you know, what I, you know, what the relationship was, which, you know, I just put down associate, friend. And all I had to do then was, you know, make sure that Ron wanted to see me, which he did on Reg's reference, and take some identification down on the day of the visit. I was booked in for the visit. I went at the time with Brad and Kim. Now, Brad and Kim, if you remember from previous episodes, were visiting Reg at the time. Brad was only 13 years of age, and he lived with his mother, Kim, and I had gone down to meet them. I'd gone down to see them as a young lad, and they had all kinds of stuff in their house. They had the wedding photos, the crazy wedding photos. They had Francis's engagement ring. They had some of Reg's old suits. They had what I could only describe as a crane museum within their house. Kim, his mother, always left me feeling rather uncomfortable. We'll come to that in later episodes. But she was peroxide blonde hair, very small and dumpy. But there was something just not quite right about her. I couldn't put my finger on it. She never made any kind of move towards me, but there was always like an unhealthy feeling whenever I visited her. She agreed, obviously, to take me to see Reg, which she duly did. And when I was invited to go and see Ron, she agreed that, you know, they would meet me at the station. I got a train from Newcastle, and rather than going to Doncaster and going down in the car with them, I got the train down to King's Cross. I got the train then from King's Cross to Reading, and then I got the train from Reading to Crowthorne in Berkshire. They picked me up at the station at Crowthorne, and then they drove me the short distance from the railway station along this winding road through lots of dense, dark forest area towards this huge, foreboding building, which, of course, was this old Victorian building, which they called Broadmoor. At the time of my first visits, they were just starting to build the new parts and modernize it a little bit. But on my very first visit, it was a case of heading up to the old entrance. You may have seen it on some of the documentaries over the years. Still Craze After All These Years is a prime example where you see somebody visiting Ron at the in Broadmoor, and it gives you a big indication of what it's like from the outside. But we walked up to that old part of the establishment. We walked through the automatic doors. Kim had a bag with her. She bought 200 John Player specials, which she left at reception for Ron to pick up. And it was pretty similar to prison, Broadmoor. You would be able to take things in for Ron in exchange for things coming back out. So if you went to see Reg, for example, and he wanted a pair of trainers, you could take a pair of trainers in from the outside, brand new. But for Reg to get those trainers, he had to send an old pair out. So it was quite the same with, it was the same with Ron and Broadmoor to a degree. He got a chance to keep a little bit more, but he would send stuff out. But yeah, that was my first lesson from Kim. If you come to visit Ron on your own, make sure you bring him some cigarettes. Make sure you bring him some biscuits. He might ask you for, different things, but just don't forget the cigarettes. Get to find out why as this particular episode continues. So once we're in, we are checked by security. Not as strict again as I would imagine it is now, but certainly not as strict as it was going into Gartree prison. Once you were checked down and made sure that you weren't taking in any contraband, we were then taken through a succession of locked doors, and then we walked across the courtyard. And that was when you got a real feeling for what Broadmoor actually was. It was a holiday for the, for the criminally insane. It was certainly not a prison. It just felt to me like a big, like a holiday camp. You're walking through, you're getting through across to this other side, and you go through this next set of doors. And as you go through the doors, you're greeted by a nurse on the other side, and they started walking us down this little corridor. And as we're walking down this corridor, and we're looking left and we're looking right, it becomes apparent that there's some actual numbers and names on some of these doors. So as you're looking at the doors, you realize that this is some of the patients' names. So I was looking along to see whether we could see Ron's name. We couldn't on this particular visit. We then walked along to this far end of the corridor, and you come to this big room on your left. You walked into the room on the left, and as you walked into the room, on your left-hand side was a stage and big red flock curtains that you would see at the theatre. And there was a lot of noise, a lot of hustle and bustle, and lots of tables and chairs. And people were starting to take their place. The nurse who was in there checked the list, explained which table you were on. You told them who you were there to visit, said Ron Cray. And we were sitting in the middle of the room, very similar to Reg and Gartry. One of the sit in the middle of the room was placed in the middle of the room. So we walked in and we took a seat. A nurse came over and asked if we would like to order any refreshments. Kim said we'd wait until Ron got there. And that was it. We waited. Everyone's visits were underway. There was no sign of Ron. And it was a bit weird at first, because I don't know what I expected to see. I expected to see maybe one flew over the cuckoo's nest. I expected to see people going crazy, doing crazy things, but it just wasn't like that. There was just lots of people sitting, chatting and talking. And then about 10 minutes into the visit, I see this small guy coming towards the door and then turning in to the same door that we came in. And looking straight across was this guy, about 5'10", sharp suit on. He had like a dark suit, pinstriped, white shirt, crisp white shirt, silk tie, gold tie pin. And he had the shiniest Gucci shoes, pair of gold-rimmed horned glasses. And as he walked towards us, you could just feel everyone's eyes turning to see him coming in. Kim got up, Brad got up, and he greeted them. And then he put his hand out to me, and in his very quiet tone, really quiet voice, he just said, "You must be Steve from Newcastle." And that was it. I shook his hand. And unlike the visit to Reg, it was very... It was almost, I wouldn't say spine tingling. It wasn't like chilling, but there was a different feeling to visiting Ron. He was paranoid schizophrenic diagnosed. This is the guy who had walked into a pub in front of witnesses and shot a man cold dead, and then walked out, gone back to his home and never given it a second thought. And then, reenacted that in his mind time and time again. I think all of that shot through my mind as we sat down. And he then clicked his fingers. And a nurse was there within seconds of him sitting down. And the guy came across and pulled out a pack of cigarettes, took out the John Player special for him, gave it to him. Ron put it in his mouth, and the nurse lit it for him. And that was it. That was the beginning of the longest smoke-a-thon I think I can ever remember. He must have gone, and bearing in mind, he used to get a pack of 20. He must have gone through two packs on that visit. He didn't smoke all of the cigarettes, but he gave it a good go. And it was almost like the stories that you hear about Ron in the books, and you see some of some of the ways he was depicted in some of the films. He loved to create that smoky atmosphere around him. He used to like that in the pubs. You read about it in many of the books. And he was holding court. The nurse came back and asked if we would like to be served refreshments, which they'd done previously. And he goes, he asks us, would we like something to eat? And I said, well, it's been a long way. I've come down from Newcastle. What did they do? And they just did the usual. They did sandwiches, they did crisps, chocolate, but they also did there was a hot food option. And on this very first visit, they were doing a cheeseburger and a bun and Coke. So, you know, I asked if I could have that. No issues with that. They went off and, you know, 10, 15 minutes later, came back. All our food was there. Our drink was there. Ron was drinking Caliber, if you remember that non-alcoholic lager. And he was having Caliber non-alcoholic lager. And I just thought, this is surreal. There's Ronnie Chris sitting, smoking away and drinking, fair enough, non-alcoholic lager. But he's dressed in a suit. He's dressed in his shirt. He's got his, you know, he's got a pinky ring on his finger, which must have been worth around about $2,000. Lovely gold watch. And he's literally holding court in Broadmoor. And as he's talking, he's, you know, I didn't know what to expect. I mean, Reg was very quietly spoken and going partially deaf in one ear. So it was very similar to speaking to Reg, but there was just more of a menace. And every now and then you would catch a glance from him, look in his eyes, and he had piercing black eyes. And he would look over, he had a way of looking over his specs at you, and you could feel him almost looking straight into your soul. It was quite a nerve-wracking experience at the time. I'd gone down dressed in a suit. Again, it was a respect thing for me. You've got to remember that at the time I was infatuated with the Cray legend. I was fascinated by the whole thing. And I clearly just felt that wearing a suit at the time was the right thing to do. It was the respectful thing to do. The visit itself was unique in the sense that this was me meeting the second twin. I'd met Reggie, and Reggie had quite clearly laid out the business kind of career side of things. He was keeping his mind active and keeping his sanity inside by writing books, promotion, keeping the career name alive. Ron was so much more chilled out because of the medication, of course. But he was very interested in the people who visited him. He was interested in who they were, what they did, what they wanted to do, what was going on the outside. He was a big boxing fan. And I was a big football and boxing fan. Ron didn't care much for football, although he could have a conversation about it. But if you got him started on boxing, he was fascinated. And of course, in the early 90s, it was all about the heavyweight division. It was about Mike Tyson. It was about, you know, some of those big names coming to the end of their career, your George Foremans. Don't forget, he'd met Joe Louis. He'd met Sonny Liston. He'd met Rocky Marciano. He'd met Rocky Graziano. He'd promoted these people in England and, you know, been part of that, you know, that touring, you know, on tourage. A bit like what I went on to do in later life with, you know, putting the boxers on up in the Northeast via Spencer Brown from Blackpool. But it was a unique opportunity to just listen to this guy. And I think if it was now, I would be doing it with other things in mind, making money, doing documentaries, whatever, you know, trying to do something with this person and trying to find out what made Ronnie Cray tick. But as a youngster who just read the books and, you know, passed an exam and written to them, none of this was planned. None of it was preempted. None of it was me setting out to do something. This was just me going with the flow. And my parents were at loggerheads over it. My dad didn't want me to go anywhere near the craze. My mom said, it's a phase. He'll get through it. Let him go. And anniversary of my mom's death last weekend. And, you know, for me personally, you know, I'll always be thankful that you did that and allowed me to make my own mind up and go and meet these people, because the one thing it did do was made me, you know, very conscious that if you commit crime, this is where you end up. And there's nothing big and clever about it. And what I'll say about visiting Ronnie Cray was that Ronnie and Reggie were very similar in that vein, that on the very first visits, they both stipulated that I should not follow in their footsteps. and that there was nothing big and clever about what they had done, and that I personally should learn from their mistake about being in there. Now, the visit to Reg, he would utilize these visits, and that very first visit to Reg went the full distance, you know, a full 2-hour visit. But with Ronnie Cray, he would arrive late and he would leave early. And, you know, I'd gone a long way. And, you know, nowadays, going down to Crowthorne in Berkshire, it's about 3 hours, maybe let's say 3 hours on the train from Newcastle to London. And then to get across to Berkshire, probably be an hour. It was a 7.5 hour journey for me to get there. And I had another 7.5 hours to go back. Ron had a 2 hour visit and he gave us 1 hour and 20 minutes. And you can't say, well, I've come a long way, Ron, can you? You've just got to go with it. As we were coming, like, you know, as we're coming to the end of this visit, Ron turns to Kim and turns to Brad and has a chat with them. And then he turns to me and says, look, Steve, I've thoroughly enjoyed the visit. Let's keep in touch. I don't keep in touch with many people, but let's keep in touch. I'll send you a letter and you'll have that. And, you know, let's see where things go and make sure you go back to see Reg. Again, just very conscious of the fact that you kept up the relationship, the friendship with the other person, the other twin. So as we're, you know, as Ron gets up and he shakes my hand and he shakes Brad's hand and he gives Kim a kiss and he walks off. As he gets to the door, he turns back, he gives a little wave, and then he's off back down the ward again. He was allowed to do that, you know, without any assistance. There was no nurse following him out the room, and off he went. We then had to wait until everyone else had finished their visit. So I had time to speak to Brad and Kim that day. And Kim said to me, I said, why is he left too early? Have we offended him? Is there something wrong? He went, no, he just likes to beat the rush. And that's Ron. You know, I want to beat the rush. You know, he didn't like to be in the corridor going out with all the other inmates and going back to the, you know, going back through an unlock and going back to his, you know, his ward with all these other people. So he preferred to get away and, you know, essentially go on his own merry way without anyone getting in his way. So that was that. The next visit came after the letter, which duly arrived 2 days later. And the letter came to me from Ron. He wasn't the greatest of letter writers. I've got an example of Ron's writing here, actually. There you go. That's Ronnie Cray's writing. I'll come to that letter in due course, but that was his writing. And that was probably the length of the letter that you would get from Ron. But his letter just thanked me for going, said he'd like to see me again. And if I had time to go, he had another visit available in a month's time. Would I like to go down on my own? So I said, yes, I'll be up for that. You know, I checked my work calendar and I thought, yeah, I'm free to do that. And I thought it would be interesting to go down and see Ron on his own. A, I would get more time with him without anybody else. And B, it would, you know, be interesting to see whether he stayed a bit longer or whether he, you know, whether he left a bit earlier. So I went through a month later, went back down to Broadmoor. And the second visit was, again, exactly the same. He arrived late. Went through the same, you know, preamble with the nurses lighting his cigarette, filling his drink, me getting a food order. I decided to have the burger. The burger was nice the first time round, so I had it the second time round. And we chatted. We spoke predominantly on that visit about boxing. We spoke a lot about Reg, who I'd been back to see in the meantime. And I had submitted an idea to Reg about creating a database. At the time, Reg was averaging 400 letters a week from people. Some people, fans, just wanting a signature. Some people who were proposing business deals. Some people who wanted to go to the charity events, which the Crays were putting on at the time, which I'll come to in a later episode. But he was just keen to know how Reg was. And that was when I learned that the twins actually had visits to each other. And they were given 3 visits a year at the taxpayer's expense. So basically they had 1 visit to Broadmoor for Reg and 2 visits to the prison for Ron. And there will be a room put aside. They would be given 2 hours to have a visit in each other's company. And this had been a decision that was made at the highest level because of the fact that they were twins. It was quite rare. They were identical twins. And the prison authorities felt, and the government clearly felt, that, you know, these people, you know, deserved that opportunity to, you know, to at least see each other in some way, shape or form 3 times a year. On that visit as well, as I finished the burger, Ron says, "Did you seem to enjoy those burgers?" And I went, "Yeah, yeah." I says, "They're nice." He said, "Well," he says, "I'll let the chef know." He says, "He's a patient here." And I went, "Oh, right, okay." And I went, you know, I never thought anything more. But he says, "Yeah, he's called Graham Young." And, and then he gave us this, like, little smirk, but never said anything more. And, of course, you know, nowadays, you'd go out the prison, you'd stick your phone on, you'd Google Graham Young to see what he was in for. But that wasn't what you could do in these days. You know, I had to wait until I got home to go on the computer and check the internet for who Graham Young was. It turns out that Graham Young was the poisoner, and he was the man who had been on duty making burgers. But Ron was winding us up. Graham Young wasn't working there that time because he died. He was testing my knowledge, I guess, of serial killers and, you know, murderers. And again, Graham Young at the time didn't mean a thing to us. If you Google Graham Young now, it's quite a story. But it was a dark side of humour, a wicked sense of humour that Ron had. But yeah, as I say, we spoke about boxing on that visit. We spoke about Reg. I spoke about the database and putting this database together of all the letters that, you know, Reg was getting. And I said, you know, if you put a database together, it means that you can then print off these people's addresses, stick them on envelopes. And Ron just loved listening to what I'd suggested. He didn't have an interest in it. He wasn't interested in making money. He liked getting money, of course, but even behind bars, Ron was still more than capable of spending more than he earned. For example, when they made the money off the Cray film in 1990, Ron and Reg and Charlie all walked away with £80,000 each or there or thereabouts. And it was gone within 12 months. You know, Ron was giving it to this person, giving it to that person, giving it to this charity, giving it to that charity, and, you know, spending it on watches and suits and, you know, it just crazy. And the way that he was dressed, you know, I mean, those suits were still tailor-made. The tailor would come in, he'd have tailor-made suits sent in from Savile Row. His white shirt, were still embossed on the pockets, RK. Silk ties on cheap, you know what I mean? The gold tie pins, the Gucci shoes. You know, he still lived that, like, extravagant life, if you like, behind bars. I also learned on that visit that he had a friend called Charlie Smith, and Charlie was on a visit to his relative that day. I can presume it was his relative anyway, but Charlie came over. He was allowed to come over and shake my hand, and Ron said it was his friend. I was obviously, years later, I learned that it was Ron's boyfriend. It was his lover behind bars in Broadmoor. He was a musician and quite a quiet person. But that was who Ron had shacked up with, if you like, in Broadmoor. The whole homosexuality thing, you know, I really didn't listen to Ron. I mean, that very first visit, I've said it time and time again, he said, "You don't mind that I'm bisexual, do you?" And it never really came into conversation after that first visit. The introduction to Charlie, he introduces him as a friend. He didn't introduce him as anything else. Obviously, I learned later life that that's who he was. But it was that second visit where he discussed going on a cruise. And this was the naivety of me as a young lad. You know, he said, I'll, you know, when I get out, I want to go on a cruise. And you know, if you know, would you like to be, you know, come? He says, there's lots of people going to go, and I'd like you to be one of those people who comes with us. And I went, as you do, you don't want to upset somebody. Yeah, you don't want to, certainly not Ronnie Cray, despite him being behind bars. But you know, I just said, yeah, I'll go on the cruise. You know, that would be great. You know, and then we just moved on to another conversation. Never spoke anything more about it. So when I got home, got back to Newcastle, a couple of days later, there's a thud at the letterbox at my mother's home, and it's a big envelope. That familiar scrawls on the front, Ronnie Cray's writing, and my mum shouts up the stairs, "Stephen, your post's here." So I go downstairs and open up this envelope, and there's this big booklet drops out, and it was Mediterranean Cruises. And a little note in from Ron, basically saying, you know, look forward to going on this cruise, you know, when I'm released. And now, obviously, you know, as a man of the world, a happily married bloke with kids, it all makes complete sense. But yeah. I didn't get the idea. I didn't get the hint of what Ron was clearly thinking when he was asking us to go on a cruise. Bizarre, funny, call it what you will, naivety, certainly on my behalf. The visit to Ron had, unfortunately, upset the apple cart with Brad and Kim. And Brad, who, you know, basically was a child, who I personally think was heavily influenced by his mother to correspond with Reg, was unfortunately like a small pawn in the game. And Reg manipulated that situation to his benefit. He had Kim running around like a blue-arsed fly, and that's the way he liked it. I'm not sure what Kim thought she was going to get out of it. I know for a fact that it didn't do young Brad any good. You know, Brad was a young lad. You know, what would he want to write to a murderer for? It just didn't make sense to me at all. But because I'd gone to see Ronnie Cray in Broadmoor, and I'd gone on my own so soon after going down with them, then Kim wasn't happy at all. And she was, you know, she was nasty on the phone. Very, you know, very annoyed that I had dared to go down to, you know, dared to go down to London with, you know, without them. And there was a jealousy there. And I never really understood why there would be a jealousy. You know what I mean? Again, naivety on my behalf, but I couldn't understand why, you know, why this woman... There she is there, and there's me outside Broadmoor with me suit on the very first visit. I couldn't understand why, you know, she was jealous of me going on this visit. What I soon learned, though, was that because of me doing that, she was keen on disrupting my relationship with Reg and with Ron. So there was a succession of letters which had been sent by Brad, and in Brad's handwriting, to say that I had essentially ripped off, you know, Brad and Kim, and as a result of that, had also ripped off Reg. And this was to do with merchandise. This was to do with hardback copies of Our Story, which was the twins' book, and of the picture disc. There was a picture disc that was brought out with Reggie Cray talking about his life on this picture disc. You'll be able to buy copies of that. Stories We Can Tell, it's called. It's on, you'll be able to get it on eBay. So Reg kindly sent me this letter and wrote on the back of it, you know, "Steve, not sure what is going on, but, you know, can you explain?" So then I had to write to Reg and explain to Reg what the situation was, that there was a jealousy there because I had gone down to see Ron. I hadn't contacted them. And that was my belief, you know, and that there was no money owing. I didn't owe anybody anything. And from, you know, from my perspective, you know, I wouldn't do that. So Reg was always quick at sending a letter back. He wrote straight back to me and said, fair enough, Steve, you know, I believe you. And just so you remember, you know, what kind of writing Reg's is, there's Reg's writing. There's a short letter there. Steve, thanks for £10, but I wanted to borrow 500, but I'm okay now. God bless, Reg. Again, we'll come to some of those bizarre stories later in another episode. But yeah, it was my first taste of jealousy within that kind of criminal interest circle, and that would bode me well for the future. It was my first thing that, you know, that I'd really learned. Visits with Ron were few and far between, and there wasn't many people on his visiting list. Charlie Cray, his brother, was on there, of course. Maureen Flanagan, the Cray's hairdresser, was on the visiting list. Laurie O'Leary, a long-term friend of the twins, and somebody who wasn't involved in crime per se, but he was involved in the entertainment industry, like the bars and the nightclub industry. And his path crossed with the Cray's on numerous occasions. And a trust was built up with Laurie to the point where when the twins were eventually jailed in 68 and lifed off in 69, Laurie was the one person that they could trust, that the twins could trust, you know, one of a small group of people who they could trust. And that was one of those people that Ron trusted implicitly. You know what I mean? He still held the purse strings for Ron. He would be a man who had a checkbook. If there was royalties to come in off of a book, or if somebody owed him something, then he was essentially the person who would, you know, would help out and chase things up. And people who you can trust in life are very hard to come by. And, you know, again, something that you only learn with a bit of life and a bit of experience in life. But for me, you know, Laurie was somebody who I would meet in later years. He was on that list as well. Those are the people who I know were definitely on. There were other people like me. There were other young lads who had gained an interest, who had written to the twins, who had potentially visited Ron or visited Reg, who kept up a relationship, kept up a friendship, kept up a pen pal relationship with these people. One of those people was a guy called Wayne Lear, who I ended up becoming and still am good friends with. Wayne, just the same as me, had an interest in true crime, but an interest in the Cray's, and, you know, wanted to, you know, essentially wanted to meet these people, and that's what he did. And he was also on the list. We never crossed over, we never saw each other, but he was again on the same, you know, on the same visit list as me. So from my perspective, that was it. I didn't know who else was on. I knew Brad and Kim were on there as well. But my path was never going to cross with Brad and Kim again. Once I had gone on that visit to Ron on my own, they didn't want anything to do with me. The last story on Brad and Kim from the 90s was when we had to go on a little journey to Wales. And there we are outside the Doncaster Bowl, which is basically where we had to go and pop in to pick up some things to take down to this meeting in Wales. And it was actually with a couple of brothers called the Frayne brothers, who had been in the papers. You know, basically the papers really hyped it up, called them the next Cray twins. There was a big case where they were allegedly going to kidnap Paul Gascoigne, and it was front page news and all the papers, and it was bad PR for the Cray's. The Cray's weren't happy with it. Reggie in particular wasn't happy because he had the most to lose with it, with an imminent parole hearing coming. So Reggie wanted us to go down and pick these books up. and picture discs and stuff that they had a hold of. There was no animosity, no problem. I went down with Brad and Kim. The journey down was fine. It was just a long journey. I got the train to Doncaster, then we drove from Doncaster to Cardiff. Kim was driving, and when we got there, we had time to pick the stuff up the lads, have a quick coffee with them, and then it was turning back round and going back to Doncaster. The problem was, though, we got lost on the motorway, and we added an extra 2 hours to our journey, and it was an absolute nightmare. Now, at the time, Kim had a mobile. Reg was ringing on the mobile, which was costing him a fortune because mobile, ringing a mobile back in the day was expensive. But imagine ringing from a prison landing with a phone cord. It was ticking over so quickly. And Reg was getting aerated because, he didn't know whether the stuff had been picked up or not. And it was just a nightmare. Kim was nearly falling asleep at the wheel. I was shattered. I'd been on the train since 6 in the morning, gone to Doncaster, and it was just a nightmare. And then I had to make my way back from Doncaster to Scunthorpe. When we got back, to go and see one of my pals who I was staying with in Scunthorpe. But that was the last time I saw them. Obviously, then those letters had come out, and the rest is history. The other bizarre situation with Ron, which again I've spoken about on many occasions, was the visit to Broadmoor, where again I got there, I got in early. Ron was late. Ron gets in, order the food, order the drink, sit down, have a little chat. Somebody came in later than Ron, and this person comes behind my chair, knocks my chair, and sits down directly behind me. And he's having a visit with this oldish woman, like a very old lady. I could hear her speak, and I could just make out like a slight Geordie accent. And as I looked across to the guy, he had black hair, sideburns, goatee beard. And I'm looking at Ron, and Ron's seething, absolutely livid. And I'm on this visit on my own. And he is not happy. He is close to boiling point. And I noticed one of the nurses coming over to me. And Ron is just going, "The slag, the slag, the slag." And I'm like looking at him going, "What the?" I said, "Look, it's okay. He just knocked me chair. He should have apologized. The slag, the, you know." And I'm going, "Look, honestly, it's okay. I really don't mind." And I said, "Who is it?" And he goes, "Sutcliffe, Sutcliffe the slag." And it was Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, who had knocked me chair. I've got to say, he remained cool, calm, and collected. Didn't say anything. Didn't react. Subsequently, I found out in later years that, of course, he had been scarred by an attack in jail, which Reggie Creed had apparently ordered on Sutcliffe when they were in Parkhurst. So he had a scar on his face from an attack from Ron, from Reg, sorry, one of Reg's friends. After that visit, and it wasn't directly after, it was a good 6 or 7 months later, there was a guy who'd gone into Broadmoor by the name of Lee Kianaida, I think that's how you pronounce it. Now, he was the Woolworths killer, and he was somebody who had killed somebody in Woolworths and been served. He'd been given a sentence. He ended up in the Broadmoor for the criminally insane. He attacked the Ripper, and again, it was prison rumor. It was Broadmoor rumor that it was Ron who ordered the attack. It was him who'd said, "I want you to do this." And he had stabbed Sutcliffe in the eye with a felt tip pen. So again, a lot of people, like years later, go, "Ah, was that because of you?" And of course it wasn't because of me. But it was clearly something which, Ron, clearly played some kind of part in. Kianaida's defense was that Sutcliffe was whistling, and he didn't like him whistling, and that was why he'd done it. But we'll never know. we'll never know why that happened. I guess there's a lot of people on the outside would be celebrating the fact that it had happened. An eye for an eye and all that. Another major thing that happened on a visit to the twin, to Ronnie Cray, was the visit that didn't happen. And I had basically been given the opportunity to go down with a friend of mine. Matthew Gregory was a big fan of the Crays. Again, similar to me, similar to me, he'd read the books, he'd watched the film, and now he wanted to go and visit. And he'd asked if it was possible. And I had to really, you know, build up that relationship with Ron. You know, that, you know, you can't just go and visit somebody and then expect, you know, when you don't know the person, expect them to say, yeah, just, you know, bring whoever you want. It wasn't a zoo, you know, it wasn't a circus. It was, you know, it's a hospital for the criminally insane, and you know, this guy's one of the most dangerous people in the world. So for me personally, I wrote a letter to Ron. I explained who Matty was, told him what the situation was, asked him if it was okay to bring a visitor, bring him to see him one day. And he didn't say yes at first, but 4 or 5 months later, I got a letter from him and said, I've got a gap on a visit. If you want to come and you want to bring your friend Matthew, then please do. So that was it. Matty was over the moon, delighted that he could come. I suggested that he wore a suit. He didn't have his own car at the time. He used to drive his dad's Honda Prelude, and that wasn't really the kind of car that would want to travel down to all the way down to Berkshire in. Matty didn't fancy getting the train. So that was it. We hired a car. We went to Hutton Hire in Newcastle, just outside of Jesmond, and we got a car from there. Can't exactly remember what it cost us to hire it, but I do remember that it was a blue Sierra, and wasn't a Cosworth, but it was a Sierra. We got the car, and we set off that morning from Newcastle at 6 o'clock in the morning, and we travelled down, and it was all I remember is it was a beautiful day. It was a lovely day for drive, and obviously we were going to be going a hell of a long way. Now, bearing in mind, every time I'd gone down there, I'd always gone down, you know, on the train, gone under my own steam, if you like. So this was a novelty for me, you know, being driven down. We had sandwiches, and I took a camera because I thought, well, Matty will be able to get a photograph outside Broadmoor like I'd done, and you know, to commemorate his first visit down there. And that was it. We headed off, and we were making great time. We got to a place called Micklefield, which is, you know, just you know, not even halfway. You know what I mean? We got to this place called Micklefield, and as we're approaching Micklefield on the motorway, a car comes screaming past us, and it's a red Sierra. And this red Sierra must have been doing at least 90. And it then we just see it hit the central reservation. Now, as we see that hit the central reservation, about 800 yards ahead of us is an articulated lorry. We were doing 80, and this car had zoomed past us. As it's hit the central reservation, all we now can see is smoke, and the smoke is billowing towards us. So this car's clearly hit the reservation. We don't know whether it's crashed and blown up. We don't know whether it's, you know, what's going on. So Matty uses his loaf, hands at the top of the steering wheel, foot fully on the brake, can't see a bat. And as the smoke clears, the articulated lorry that was 800 yards ahead of us went out right under it. And we clipped the bottom of it. And as we clipped the bottom of it, we flipped. We spun once, bang, on the roof. Spun again, bang, onto the top of the central reservation. And then bang, again. The car lands on its wheels. and were directly on the other side of the motorway, facing oncoming traffic at 6:45 in the morning. We are so lucky. The windscreen goes in slow motion. That's all I can remember. I remember the bangs. I remember spinning around. And I remember the windscreen just going in slow motion. And then I remember looking. The car roof has come in because we've hit it twice. And it's touching my left shoulder. And I've got a suit on. And I just remember looking straight ahead. Things then went back into normal time. And as we're looking straight ahead, I can see cars coming towards us, but not quickly. They're slowing down. We're just dead lucky there was nothing coming at the same time. Otherwise, you know, God knows what would have happened. So Matty's going, "You all right? You all right?" I went, "Yeah, you." He went, "Yeah, yeah." Apart from this bit of blood, yeah. And Matty had a tiny scratch on his left finger on his right hand. And I had a tiny rip in my suit. Managed to kick the door open. I got out of my door. He got out of his door. And we both went and stood on the central reservation. As we look down the motorway on the other side of the road, the trucks come to a stop. The lorries come to a stop. Big Arctic come to a stop. We hit it that hard that its middle has dropped. So the chassis smashed. And that can't move. And if you look further down, the red car, which has caused all this mayhem, is smoking away on the central reservation. The boot's open, and a load of pigeons are flying out. So anyway, the police arrive, the ambulance arrives, give us the once-over. Matty has to call the car hire company. He was in with the RAC, so the RAC came. And that was it. We got towed away, going, you know, back home rather than down to Broadmoor. So I ring Broadmoor up and explain the situation. I tell them that, you know, I'm supposed to be visiting Ronnie Cray today with my friend Matty. We can't come. We've been involved in a serious road traffic accident. We've got to go back to Newcastle now. The car's a write-off. Luckily, I'd taken the camera. So I took a lot of snaps of the car. And I took all the, you know, I think I took 20 odd photographs of it. I should have loaded some on here, but I'll show it on the next show. But this car was a write-off. So we're towed back to Newcastle, which took about 2.5 hours, an hour for the RSC to come and get the car on the low loader and then back to Newcastle. We got to Hutton Heigher. I mean, they just looked at the car and went, well, it's written off, but luckily Matty was insured. I think overall it was going to cost us in the region of £400 to get it, you know, to get it all sorted out. We then got dropped off at a local pub, which isn't there anymore, called the Farmer's Rest at Haymarket. And me and Matty went in. And I'm not being funny. We literally, with the hypertension that was caused from that accident, I think we had 5 pints in about 45 minutes and they didn't touch the sides. And I think we both just had time to reflect then about how bloody lucky we'd been that we didn't die. Absolutely mental. Somebody was looking after us that day. I don't know who it was, but somebody was looking after us. Nobody was looking after Ron, though, because my phone call to Broadmoor, which had been received, wasn't passed on to Ron. And they basically allowed Ron to go in on the visit and sit and have nobody there. Mental cruelty at its finest. They knew I wasn't coming. And for me personally, that was disappointing to hear that, you know, they'd done that. I then got a letter from Ron, who wasn't happy at all that I hadn't gone on this visit. And that's what this letter's all about. Steve, you have right disappointed me. You have let me down. I want you to give the £100 to Kim. It is important that you do. I am very upset about you letting me down, Ron. And you can see the date there at the top, actually. the Saturday, the 4th of May, 1991. So that was the date of that visit. That he'd clearly gone straight back after he sat on that visit by himself and wrote that letter. So I went off to the shop, True Print, I think it was called, and got the film developed of the car and the state of the car. And I sent it to him and showed him exactly what we'd been involved in. I wrote him a letter and explained exactly what had happened. The problem was that all of this takes time. It's not like the modern day system where I could have emailed the prisoner and he would have got it within a day or 2 days, and I could have sent him a photograph via that as well. I had to go to True Print. The turnaround, there was no such thing as 24-hour turnaround in them days, or 2-hour turnaround as you can probably get now. It was come back in a couple of days. So I got them photos done in a couple of days. Then I had to send them to him and the letter. So you're talking a full week, I think it was, before the turnaround. But you know what? When I got those, when he got them, fair play to Ron. I got a letter basically from him explaining that he was sorry. Forgive me for having a go at you. Your pal, thanks, God bless, Ron. And then be possible for you to come on the 25th of May, Saturday afternoon. It will be okay. God bless, Ron. After that, two checks arrived. One from a guy called Nick Treby, and another one from Kim, his wife. £400 Ron sent us, and he paid for the car, so me and Matty weren't out of pocket. Very good of him. Very nice of him. Didn't have to do that. But clearly, when he'd seen the photographs of the car, he'd realised what had happened. And I also explained in the letter that, you know, I had rung Broadmoor, but they clearly hadn't passed on the, you know, the details of the crash. So that was that. The relationship with Ron was different to Reg. And I've already mentioned that at the start. A lot of this was down to the fact that, as I say, Ron was more interested in your personal life, what you were up to, you know, how your job was going. I mean, at the time, I had the post office in Wardley and Gateshead. Some of you who watch the channel will know that, you know. There's one of the articles. Postie fights for Cray's release from those very early days. That was a march on Downing Street. A Tyneside man is leading a campaign to have gangsters twins Ronnie and Reggie Cray freed from jail. Steve Wraith, 21, a Gateshead post office worker, is helping to organise a march on Downing Street on Saturday to coincide with the brother's 60th birthday. The Cray's supporters club will march to number 10 to lobby for the brothers to be granted parole. The campaign is gathering pace and attracting support from celebrities, including EastEnders star Mike Reid, pop singer turned actress Patsy Kensett, as well as thousands of ordinary people. So, you know, the post office, that's one of those picture discs, actually, that I was talking about. But yeah, I mean, the publicity was, again, it was something which benefited the twins. There's another picture, you know, Steve Head's march to free Reggie Cray. Dear me, look how young I am there. Crikey. But yeah, it's one of those situations which, for me, you know, visiting Reg became about keeping the name in the paper, raising their profile, doing books such as this one, Verses from Villain Reggie, Heworth Man edits Cray poems. That was when Reggie asked us to do his poetry book. But with, as I say, with Ron, it was more of, you know, it was more to do with, you know, the, you know, just the friendship, I guess. You know, he enjoyed having a visit. He enjoyed listening to what I was doing. And when I moved from the post office and went into doing the doors, he would give us advice about nightclubs, what to expect, what to do. Although, you know, some of the things that Ron would do aren't quite the things I would have to do in a professional capacity as a doorman. But for me, it's, you know, I look at it and it's not something that that I regret. The visits to Ron changed, though, and they changed because Ron's mental health changed. And that might sound bizarre because he's in Broadmoor, and you know he's in a hospital, but smoking, you know, 40 on a visit, and God knows how many he smoked during the day. Even if it wasn't a full cigarette, was never going to do him the world of good, and his health did start to suffer, and he never looked great. He never looked well, and always very old and very frail compared to Reg, who, when I first went to see him, was, you know, he was the, you know, the bench, you know, the bench press champion in Gartry when I went to see him, you know, the biggest bench press, you know, in the jail at the time. So for me personally, you know, to hear that Ron's health was deteriorating was bad enough, but then going on visits to see him and seeing how he deteriorated, it was sad in a lot of ways. And as I got older, I think I realized as well, you know, that, you know, this person, you know, this person and what he did, I never condoned what they did. I never said, you know, I condone what they've done. I was always, you know, very aware that these two guys were murderers, but there's something that just drew us into that story. I can never explain it because I was, you know, I was at school. I was 15, 16, 17, and then going into me later years, 18, 19, 20, 21. And, you know, it wasn't until Ron's funeral where I think I had that eureka moment. But a couple of visits I went to Ron, it was sad to see him. I'll take you through the visit with Matty first, though. We did manage to rearrange that visit for the 25th of May after the car crash. And we drove down. We got there. We got there on time. Went through the usual entrance into Broadmoor. We got into Broadmoor. Matty finally meets Ronnie Cray. Ron was a bit off that day. And he was quiet. And whereas when I'd gone, he wanted to know all about us. What I did, you know, what was my job, what interests did I have, etc. He didn't do any of that with Matty. He wanted, you know, he just sat, and it was almost like an uncomfortable silence at one point. And then he looked at Matty, he looked at me, and he goes, "I think your friend better go now. Thanks for coming." And he stood up and shook his hand and more or less dismissed Matty after about 10 minutes. And that was it. So he'd had the opportunity to meet him. He shook his hand. And he was dismissed from, you know, me and Steve have got things to discuss. Wow. Unbelievable. Matty never went to see Ron again, needless to say. At least he can say he met him. But he wasn't very happy, believe you me. Didn't blame me, of course. Wasn't my fault. But clearly I'd made the right impression for whatever reason. But, you know, or caught Ron on the bad day. But fast forward now to that last year of visits, and as this show comes to an end, that he started to look every bit of the madman that I thought he was gonna be when I went there. A paranoid schizophrenic. You read stories about him when he didn't used to take Stematol in the 60s, and he was drinking and he was taking drugs and he was missing his medication, and you know, he would be talking to himself, he would shave half of his face and leave the other half to grow, and you hear all these mad stories, read them all. Whether they're true or not, I don't know. I wasn't there. But they're in books. You take out of it what you want to take out of it. But it was sad to see him in that last 12 months. He'd lost weight. He looked older. He had a bit of colour when we first met him, but now he was grey. He had a cough. And one of the last visits I had with him, I got a letter off him, and the letter that I got off him was very disturbing. You've seen his handwriting. I've already put it up there, but this particular letter that I got off him was written over, not once, not twice, but three times. So he'd written a letter, but he'd gone over the letters individually three times at least, maybe four. It looked manic. It looked insane. And although the letter made sense, it was distressing to see that somebody mentally was in that position and done that kind of thing to a letter. It just, you know, there was too many letters to do that to as well. It looked awful. So I went to see him on this. It was the last visit I had with him. The person who had actually had the last visit with him was Wayne Lear, who I mentioned earlier. He was the last recorded visitor to see Ronnie Crane Broadmoor. But my visit, I'd gone to see him, and he came in more or less straight after me. But he looked drugged up to the eyeballs. His hair wasn't combed to the usual immaculate style. He had a blue sweater on, which had egg stains down the front. He had a pair of unironed grey pants on and a pair of black shoes, which weren't the usual Gucci's. And the visit was awful. He was literally incapable, really, of having a conversation. And I know sometimes they used to change his drugs and they used to mess around with his drugs. But on this particular visit, I just don't know what was the matter with him. And it was only a couple of months later that I had another visit booked in, and that visit never happened. And subsequently then, in, you know, early part of 1995, he was taken to hospital with a suspected heart attack. And, you know, he never really recovered. He went back to Broadmoor, went back to the hospital, and he died on Comic Relief Day in February 1995. I was at the post office that day when that phone call came through. And it was Reggie Cray that rang us at 8:45 in the morning to tell us that Ron had died. He was very cool. He was very calm. He was very, you know, collected. He was clearly shocked at, you know, the news, but he wasn't crying. He wasn't emotional. He was just somebody who had lost his twin brother and had clearly decided that he was going to focus on making sure that his twin brother got the send-off that he deserved. So that's it. That is the episode on Ronnie Cray. Hell of a character. Got to know him over a 5-year period. Got to know him better than a lot of people did. And also got an opportunity to, you know, to correspond with him. I do have something rather special from him. And that is a drawing of a boxer. Which is that. Ron never used to draw. Reg was the drawer. Reg would always draw little sketches. And I'd got this one from Reg in early life, in our, you know, when we first started to visit each other. He'd sent us a cowboy, he'd sent us a sailor, which he was profound for, but he sent us that. So I asked Ron to do one, and that's what I got. Not quite Van Gogh. But nice to have. And because I'm a boxing fan and because the twins were boxing fans, it was nice to be able to get that. Photograph I missed out as well. There's Laurie O'Leary. That's Les Martin on the left. Me, Laurie O'Leary, and Stu Wheatman, who went on to write my book with me, The Crays, The Geordie Connection. So the next episode, I'm going to focus not on Ronnie's funeral. We will come to that. But I'm going to feature this man. Again, another photo from Britain's Gangland. Go and subscribe to that on the Facebook pages. If you want to subscribe to my Facebook pages on The Crays, it's The Crays, From the Cradle to the Grave. Get yourself onto there and you can subscribe to that. Some great stuff on there. But yeah, I'm going to focus on Charlie Cray. And there he is with, for those football fans, Carol Gascoigne, Gazza's mother. And Tony Lambriani, of course, who was part of the firm, they came up to do a charity show for me in Newcastle, which we will focus on in the next episode. But I'll dip into the chat. I'll have a look at the questions and comments. Trev. Hi, guys. It's Trev, singer, songwriter. Just to say hello. I love this one. God bless you, Steve. Could you please try and give me a picture of The Crays? Please contact me. Thanks. Trevor Dookie. Plenty photos of The Crays, mate. I'll have a look for you on social media, mate. Tom Dixon, good evening. Big Billy, I hope you're well, pal. Top man. I missed the funeral of Ronnie Creagh because I was doing a charity gig in Wales. I wasn't happy. I missed Reg Creagh as well. All right, okay, mate. Positive vibes. Good evening. He did like to smoke. You are not wrong. Positive vibes. David Last, good evening. Thought you might join us. Did they ever speak about the past or were they generally future focused? David, Ronnie Creagh, I think I've told you this before, spoke to me once about the shooting of Cornell, and he said he'd, you know, he played it back in his mind many times and it got him excited. He always spoke with glee, said about it. It was something that he didn't regret doing, because if Cornell hadn't been taken out, then he felt he, you know, he could have been killed by Cornell or any one of the Richardson gang. But yeah, he spoke about it once. He very rarely spoke about the past. He spoke about his mum on visits. He spoke about Doris Stokes, of course, who he used to have visits from, another one who was on his visiting list. Spoke very highly of her. Spoke about the film. We spoke about, you know, the people that Reg trusted and he didn't trust. Pete Gillette being one. How right was he about him? The guy turned out to be, you know, an absolute wrong'un. But I think Reg would often look at people through financial eyes, but Ron would suss people out and be a better judge of character. And they often disagreed on certain people. They never really, they very rarely fell out, which is, you know, no surprise. They didn't spend time with each other. You know, they were, you know, Ron was in Broadmoor, Reggie was in like a selection of different prisons. But you know, I just think there was difference. You could see how they worked well together on the outside, but you could also see how, you know, how things went pear shaped. Do you know what I mean? You can see how they didn't work well, because, you know, Reg liked to make money and knew how to make money. Ron just knew how to spend money, and that still continued. They made more money behind bars, and I'll go into that when I do the next episodes over the course of the next couple of weeks. I'm not sure how many episodes I'm going to do, but I've got to cover Charlie next. I've got to cover Ronnie Creagh's funeral, which was a huge event. Probably another 3 or 4 episodes. You know, I might do a general chat about them as well, but I just wanted to finish it off because, as I say, this was a lockdown thing, which I never saw through, which I really should have done. I think I mentioned in the Reggie Creagh one about him speaking about the past, David. You might want to revisit it, but that was part 3. But yeah, Reg did speak about the past, and usually because it would creep up in the press, it would creep up in the papers. I think I mentioned the visit that I had with Reg in one of the jails, where it was in the newspapers that Tony Lambriano was front page of the newspaper, saying he knew where Jack the Hat's body was buried. And I went in on a visit this day, and Reg was absolutely foaming because Reg's parole was coming up that week. And Tony had spoken to the newspapers and said that he knew where Jack the Hat's body was buried. It was a load of rubbish. It was, you know, it was a lie. It was a chance to sell a story to the newspapers. Tony wasn't aware that Reg's parole was coming up, but it had put Reg Creagh on the front page of the newspapers for all the wrong reasons. Probably a setup by the newspapers, knowing fine well what it would do. But Tony fell for it, hook, line, and sinker, and took an earner out of it. And Reg never spoke to Tony again after that. But he was foaming that day. And I got a long, deep, and meaningful conversation that day about how it was kill or be killed, that Jack the Hat had come to the club and shot the club up, and had he not dealt with the situation, that he would have, you know, he could have been killed by Jack the Hat. And, you know, Ron had told him to do Jack the Hat in because he killed Cornell, and it was as simple as that. You know, I had a couple of conversations like that with Reg. He would also talk about Francis. I don't think there was a visit went by where he wasn't at least a reference to Francis in some way, shape, or form. He loved her. He never consummated the marriage, but he loved her, and he treated her and put her on a pedestal. But because he was a closet homosexual back in the day, he never consummated the marriage, you know. And I really, when you read the Creagh story, I feel very sorry for Reg, because he would never admit that he was dominated by his other, you know, his other half, if you like, the other half of me, as he described him on his reef. But he was dominated by Ron. Ron was a paranoid schizophrenic who was mentally ill, who was violent and psychopathic, and who essentially could probably get the better of Reg on a lot of things, apart from a fight. And Ron would fight dirty, and Reg was a professional. He could have been a professional boxer. And I think I often, when I, you know, look back at the story, I feel sorry for Reg, because had he not been a twin, had he been Reg Cray with an older brother called Charlie, he probably would have gone on and been a very successful boxer or a very successful businessman. I don't think he would have turned to villainy. But because he had a brother who was always dependent on him and always leading him down the wrong path, that's unfortunately what happened, you know. Reg Cray is a sad story, really. He was guilty as hell, and he admitted, you know, and why he did it. And I think as well, he never got out because he never showed any remorse, you know. And he said he would never show any remorse because he didn't regret doing it. So why should I lie? Why should I show remorse? And I don't think, I mean, when I went to see Ron and we spoke about Reg, his main focus in the 5 years that I visited Ron was getting Reg out. Do you know what I mean? I don't care about me. I'd rather die in Broadmoor. I'm happy here and I'd rather die here. It's all about getting Reg out. But Reg would never say that Ron was the dominant twin and he was the evil twin. And I think that's, you know, it came out when Ron died, of course, which we'll go into in a couple of episodes time. He spoke in depth about, you know, in books and stuff that came out that, you know, it's all my fault kind of thing, you know, but it was too late, you know, that the Stud and the Old Billy together, you know, they were tried and convicted together. And as far as the government was concerned and the authorities were concerned, they were both as culpable and as guilty as each other and deserved the same sentence, and that's it. Had Reg come out and distanced himself from Ron, which he was never going to do, I think things would have been a lot different, you know. But people often say, which one did you prefer to visit? Which brother did you prefer? Out of the twins, I definitely preferred Ron, because he was just, it was, the visits were good crack. Do you know what I mean? They were, you know, they were what you expected them to be. They were, you know, a chat with a guy who's interested in boxing, football, you know, and life. Had conversations about, you know, the man on the moon to God knows what with Ron, whereas Reg literally was business. You know what I mean? He was constantly wanting to make money and constantly chasing up people who owned him, owed money, or, you know, people who had money who might want to invest in something, or what do you think about this book, and do you know somebody who can print these flyers off, and what about the t-shirts, so we're making good money on them, and I've been offered an opportunity to do this, and, you know, I very rarely got demands from Ron about taking stuff in. As long as he took his John Player specials in, he was happy. But with Reg, you know, we would get requests to bring in trainers, vests, you know, tracksuits, you know, and what did he get in return? You know, very little, apart from, you know, the Christmas visit that I had with Reg, where, you know, I ended up with a box full of other people's things. You know, he'd done a collection. It was nice of him to do that. But I think I mentioned I got a naff pencil. I got a pencil case. I think I got a cowbell. Bizarre. Where the hell that came from, I've got no idea. An ashtray, which Reg had made in jail. Loads of little things, like in a box, which he gave us because I went on a Christmas visit to Reggie. I'll have to double check whether I mentioned that in the Reggie Cray episode. I haven't listened it back. I haven't listened back to it. But if not, I'll take you through that at some point, but this was about Ron. I've took you on the full journey of Ron Cray. What I'll do in the next episode is I will take you all on the full journey of Charlie Cray. Probably in a couple of weeks' time. If I can do it next week, I will. But I think it'll more than likely be a couple of weeks' time when I do it. But I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have, hit the like button. Click the share button if you're a member of a gangland group. on Facebook, or you know somebody who wants to listen to it, please do. Please subscribe to the channel, because it is free to subscribe. If you want to join, it's $1.99 a month. Click the join button just to support the channel. Any finance coming in to help us is beneficial. I've also set up another YouTube channel, which is called The True Crime Channel. Go across and subscribe to that. Again, it's free to subscribe. And that is predominantly going to have all my true crime videos on there that I've done, and that I've, you know, some of them are documentaries, some of them are stuff that we've done. But, you know, go across there. I'm going to gradually add all the true crime stuff to there. But if you can drop that a sub as well, that would be great. And if you're into books and into reading, get yourself to www.badboysbooks.net. And there's plenty of books on there. Some that I've written, some that I've just published. But get yourself over there and treat yourself. I'll leave you. I'm just going to leave you with another little clipping. I'm just going through these clippings here just to go through. Craze Cash for Sick Tot. Got that to come to, which was an event that we did. And that one, Cray Twins, right to Magpies Magazine. Wow, that was the very first. That was the very first correspondence that I had with the Twins. Good publicity for the magazine, that, though. Although a little bit bizarre to Newcastle fans to see the Craze linked with Newcastle United. Okay, thanks for joining us. I hope you enjoyed it. I will be back soon. I won't leave it another 18 months. I'm going to play out with the ads. Thanks very much for listening, guys.
A big shout out to all our sponsors. Thanks to Skips and Bins, telephone 0800 25 45 253, email inquiries at skipsandbins.com, website skipsandbins.com, easy contract free and pay as you go waste collection. Thanks to Mr. Vicky's Sauces, handmade in Cumbria. You can order them from their website, mrvickys.co.uk, or by calling 01768 210 102. Thanks to Media Arts for all the help with the video technology. Thanks to qtechshop.co.uk, the makers of pool tables and snooker tables in Wallsend, Newcastle. If you enjoy the show, please hit the little thumb under the video and like the video. Click share to share to your other social media, or subscribe. It's free and we do 7 shows a week. If you want to become a member, you can click join underneath this video. There are different packages to suit all different pockets. And if you want to become a cult member, then put your smartphone over the QR code. It'll take you straight there to the website, which is nufcmatters.com. If you go in via the website, just click membership pack. What do you get for your money? You get a pen, you get a cup, you get a membership card and a scarf, and entry into the monthly draw. Don't forget, we are available as a podcast on iTunes, Spotify and other podcast providers. And we also support the food bank on this show. NUFCFansFoodBank.co.uk is where you'll find the matchday bucket. You can make a virtual donation today. We've also got some events coming up over the next couple of months. An evening with Peter Beardsley at the Tyneside Irish Centre. Tickets available from NewcastleLegends.com. Or go to Woucher and get a 40% discount. Our end of season do is the 27th of May at the Tyneside Irish Centre. Tickets are a tenner from nufcmatters.com. An evening with Gavin Peacock takes place on July the 10th at the Tyneside Irish Centre. Tickets from nufcmatters.com for that event. And the following night, Gavin will be at the Time House Surf Cafe. Go to their website for ticket information. We've got a vast range of T-shirts, merchandise and memorabilia available at our website. The Ezak T-shirt is doing well. Go to nufcmatters.com to buy one today.